Proverbs 23 is a proverb that a lot of these proverbs revolved around this one fruit of the Spirit the Bible speaks about. You know some of the fruits of the Spirit. The fruit of the Spirit is love. In the sense of it really being the fruit of the Spirit, manifestations of love is joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness. And that last one, self-control. Being able to control yourself. The Proverbs have already said that if you can rule over your spirit, you can rule 10 cities. It's not an easy task in front of us. And as those of you who have been with us in the Proverbs have seen how many times that this has stirred up an awareness of our flesh that maybe we didn't see, and a consciousness of sin that wasn't pleasant, yet it drew us closer to the Lord that we might lean upon Him for His strength and His power to get through that and to overcome those issues of our lives. Proverbs 23 is largely dealing with a number of aspects of controlling self. But I want to say a few things before we delve into this. When we encounter the Lord, our Creator, our Redeemer, and we discover Him to be the lover of our souls and one who can help us overcome the destructive forces of this world, we are filled with that awe and wonder. Why did we wait so long to come to Him, we wonder. Why don't others see how awesome He is? And this is what I would call the honeymoon stage of our experience with the Lord. You know, that all is new and wonderful. You're elated with God. The weight of guilt is off your shoulders. You're experiencing that wonderful acceptance in His love. You are overcome that despite your weakness and sin, He forgives you. And like a giddy child taken up with the wonder of the world, you're just, it's a whole new dimension for you. It's exciting. This is indeed how the Lord would want us to stay. But there are many obstacles to that rich experience. We've been born again, but we need to know as His seed of love is planted in us, our hearts are hostile ground. And it takes some plowing, it takes some development. And, you know, when we revert back to our old ways, sometimes we wonder, did really anything happen to me, or was it just a feeling that faded? And so we wonder about this, but we know there is indeed a change, but why do we still struggle with patterns of selfishness and desire of the past, the desires of sin? Well, the Bible calls it in the New Testament, the old man. Now, you've been born again, you've got a new heart, but that old man is still trying to hang around. And we're called to reckon it dead, to consider it dead, and us alive unto God. But that takes that aspect of walking by faith, it takes some practice, it takes time to realize these things. Like Israel, we came out of Egypt, the world. But before we get to the promised land, there's that wilderness we go through. And in many respects, that's what we're going through. You know, to learn how to let the Lord be Lord of our life, to let Him be the leader, to be our pilot. I saw a bumper sticker that said, God is my co-pilot. It doesn't work that way. If He's not your pilot, then your ship is not going in the right direction. But when God is your pilot, when He is your Lord, and you've learned to trust Him, you come into that promised land. But the wilderness comes after this honeymoon experience. And you wonder, what's going on? Why am I still struggling with these things? But He is taking you, if you trust Him, into that promised land. He's going to protect you during the meantime from attack and from hunger. He is going to bring you into that promised land full of milk and honey. Now, the promised land does not represent heaven. In the Old Testament, as many of the old hymns and songs try to express, the Promised Land really, because even when they came into the Promised Land, they still fought with the enemy. But they lived victoriously. They claimed the mountains that the giants controlled. They took over the land, and in many respects, as a Christian, as you're growing, you start having more and more victory over yourself and over the things of this world. Now, some of you are in that honeymoon stage, and it's glorious. You're just so excited. But you have yet to discover the things that will test your I do to the Lord. And it will test, just like any marriage. That I do that you give will be tested. But some of you have already entered the promised land, and that you are walking in victory. You've pretty much, it doesn't mean you're perfect. It means that for the most part, you're not going to let those giants scare you off. You're going to keep going forward. You're walking with the Lord and you're claiming more and more land that He's promised. But the greater portion of Christians, unfortunately, are still in that wilderness experience. They've come out of the honeymoon stage. They haven't quite entered into that victorious Christian walk. they're still in that place of stumbling. They're not, you know, yielded to the Lord in certain areas of their lives, and it comes back to hurt them. They wonder why it's so difficult to be a Christian. And they haven't come to that point like Job came to when he resolved, though he slay me, I will trust in him. And that's where victory begins. That's where the promised land begins. But in the meantime, during this encounter, Proverbs, our boot camp, has been shedding from us certain vestiges of flesh and sin that we need to have shed. We need to have exposed. So when we jump into the Proverbs with that in mind, now we're going to learn some principles of controlling self and some dangers to our soul that wily self causes us so much grief. Self-control, that fruit of the Spirit that we so desperately need. So having said that, let's jump in to verse 1 of Proverbs 23. He says, when you sit down to eat with a ruler, consider carefully what is before you, and put a knife to your throat if you are a man given to appetite. Do not desire his delicacies, for they are deceptive food. This first exercise in controlling self is self-restraint here. Opportunity has hit you. You've been invited to dinner by a prominent person of rank, and the Bible cautions you. If you're a man given appetite, control it. Consider what is before you. What? Consider what? Consider the type of food? No. Consider what's really happening here. Be wise. Where are you? What is the temptation here? What impression will you leave with this person? Indulging appetites and loose and frivolous conversations are very tempting to the flesh. And so you need to be wise and consider that. Now, strong language is used here. Put a knife to your throat. Strong language, poetic language. Obviously, the implication is not to pick up one of the dinner table knives and hold it literally to your throat, but to control your appetite. Why such strong language? Because the flesh is strong. Here you are in a situation that is quite amazing. It's, wow, I've only eaten like pasta for the last 6 weeks in a row. Now I can have filet mignon and lobster and all this stuff. And woo, go for it. But it says, no, be careful. Be stern with your flesh. Resist the indulgence. You know, before we can truly enjoy the fullness of life, one of the secrets of that is learning how to restrain yourself. Because it says here, his delicacies are deceitful. How so? How are his delicacies deceitful? Well, sometimes they're deceitful from the insincerity of the host. There's an ulterior motive that you must discern. Why is he being so nice to you? Why did he invite you? Why are you there? You need to consider that. But also, well, not only is it sometimes from the insincerity of the host, always, always it's deceitful from the disappointment. You see, most of what we enjoy in life comes from the anticipation of receiving something. You know what it's like to go into the store, you see something you want, the anticipation of owning that, you bring it home, and it always disappoints. It's never all that you'd hoped it would be. You're sitting in a restaurant and you're looking at the menu and you know what you can afford, but oh, you know, you're going to splurge just this once because that looks so good. So you go for the most expensive thing on the menu and you're all excited. Ooh, I can't wait. And you get it and it's okay. What happened? Because the anticipation of something is always better. This is the trick of this world, the flesh, the deception of it. The anticipation is more than the realization. And we need to understand that. So don't desire his delicacies, for they're deceptive food. Oh, they look so tantalizing, and after you eat them and indulge yourself, it really didn't satisfy you like you thought. Paul the Apostle expressed this need. He says, I discipline my body and bring it into subjection. Peter expresses for this reason in 1 Peter 3, or 2 Peter 1 actually, he says, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, to virtue knowledge, to knowledge self-control. It's a necessary aspect of true fulfillment in your life. And so he expresses, don't desire, put a knife to your throat. The idea of controlling. Now there is a controlling of the flesh that is extreme in nature. Some might reason, well, if a little control is good, a lot of control will be better. And sometimes they go too far with this self-made religion of disciplining themselves and going into a monastery and torturing the flesh and going to a place where they think they're going to draw closer to God for all of their rigorous exercises. The Bible also says to that, not so. For that indeed is a self-made religion. Self-control isn't meaning you deny all of your desires, just some of them, that can turn out to be a bad way. And you need to discern that. And this is what is being expressed here. Now the second exhortation about controlling self is found in verse 4 through 8, actually. Greed and covetousness. He says, do not overwork to be rich, because of your own understanding cease. That is, you know, you figure out that it's not going to mean all that it means, so cease. Will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings, and they fly away like an eagle toward heaven. Again, the importance of recognizing the emptiness in the long run of riches. See, if you're rich and it came from God's blessing, awesome. Be thankful. Consecrate your riches unto the Lord and use them freely for His purposes. There is no place in the scripture that commands the rich to give all to the poor, to give it all away. The one parable that might come to mind on that was before that man came to Jesus, that rich young ruler, riches were a stumbling block. They were preventing him from coming to Jesus. Jesus counseled him wisely, give it all away. If you can come and follow me, you'll have treasures in heaven. But that's not the New Testament commandment for all the rich. Paul tells us in 1 Timothy 6, command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, not to trust in the uncertainty of riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. And they should be ready to share and eager to do good things with what they have. That's the command for the rich. But here we're told, don't overwork to be rich. If you work and you become rich, awesome. But you see, the danger is to forget your priorities, to do more than is right with the precious time that you have to obtain temporary riches. That is unwise. See, if you're going to sacrifice needful things, like getting into the Word of God and growing personally, and fellowshipping with other believers, and using your time and your talents to serve the Lord in some capacity, if you must sacrifice those to obtain riches, it is not wise. Why does he say that? He says, why would you set your eyes on that which is not? Again, riches is another one of those deceptions. The Bible speaks about the deceitfulness of riches choking out the fruitfulness of God's word in your life. They're deceitful. They promise, but they don't really fulfill. They appear, but they're not really what they appear to be. You know, riches are an illusion. Now, in those days where riches were tangible commodities, even they were deceptive. In our day, even more so, because much of our wealth is on paper. You have a paper that says you own your house. Well, actually, the bank owns it. You owe the bank. You have a paper that shows how much stocks and bonds and what your holdings are. But you saw how easily that can go from up here to down here in a short amount of time. It's really much more of an illusion. Paper that shows my wealth isn't really worth it, because I can't really enjoy it while it's on paper anyway. It's there for the future, which may or may not come, because only the Lord knows what the future. It could be that the stocks could crash, the bonds could crash, and the whole thing could go under. We don't know how certain things are. And I can tell you this, with the integrity issues that were revealed with the Enron debacle, we are only seeing the tip of the iceberg. Who knows? Because it's not a matter of whether the wealth and the opportunity is there in America. It's regarding the dishonesty and the integrity of many people that's in question. He says, don't eat the bread of a miser, nor desire his delicacies, for as he thinks in his heart, so is he. Eat and drink, he says to you, but his heart is not with you. Again, the insincerity of people of greed. Miser is not the best translation of the word there, but the translators use it. It's greedy person. I think all the good words were used in other translations, and they can't copy the other one, so they threw this one in. But that happens sometimes in your translations, and even the New King James has some weaknesses. But it does convey, don't eat the bread. Don't be in that place, because there's something going on behind the scenes. We have to be aware of ulterior motives sometimes. Why am I here? Why am I with this person? Why are they indulging me in these things? And it says here, as he thinks within his heart, so he is. Eat and drink, he says, but his heart's not with you. Now, certain metaphysical teachers and faith teachers have ripped this verse out of context so as to mean that as you think within your heart, so you can become and you are. And so try to put good thoughts and think about, positive things. You're wonderful. Everyone thinks well of you. You can actually get little cassette tapes you can put in your car and you can hear this babble. Constantly pumping yourself up, because as you think within your heart, so you are. But as you can see from the context, that's not what it means here at all. It simply means it's not how nice he is and how pleasant he is towards you. It's what he's really thinking about you in his heart. That's what it means here. Be wise in that. Now, the third thing he expresses to control, not only should we control our and resist our, appetites, control our temptation to greed, but in verse 9, he says we need to control our words. He says, do not speak in the hearing of a fool, for he will despise the wisdom of your words. There's a time to talk and a time not to talk. There's a time to share your faith and a time to be silent. And we need to learn this, speaking, control it. For in the presence of a fool, it says your words are despised. Now remember, the fool, the word fool is not intellectual. It's moral. It's one who has decided there is no God. He says in his heart there is no God. And he says, don't speak in the presence of such a one, for he's going to despise the wisdom of your words. Jesus even said, don't give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine. Now, did Jesus mean to convey that all the people out there that don't know him are swine and dogs and you should have nothing to do with them? Obviously not. He's not referring to, but the point of the lesson is dogs and pigs won't enjoy jewelry. They can't appreciate jewelry. They don't care. Give them a nice steak or a nice place to wallow in and they'll be happy. The point is that what God has done in your life, there may be people around you that do not appreciate it, do not see it, and don't appreciate what God has done in your life. What should you do? Well, there's a time to speak and a time not to speak. I think sometimes Christians, in their zeal and their excitement, they want to share with everybody. But even Paul the Apostle, as bold as he was constantly praying and asking for prayer to have wisdom to know or to have an effectual door to share his faith. You see, he didn't go willy-nilly down the street, grabbing everybody, grabbing them, saying, you got to hear about Jesus. He was wise. He said, Lord, give me that open door. He didn't push it on people. He was careful to look for those opportunities. And so we should be. I mean, if you think if you get in trouble on your job for sharing your faith, you've got to discern. Is it an unreasonable expectation that your employer has put before you that everyone can sit around the lunch table and talk about all the other subjects and you can't talk about the Lord? Or is it you're not being wise? You're spending his time talking to people. You're not being wise with whom you're talking with and you're stirring up people's anger. If these are situations that you're doing, then you need to stop. And then if you get fired for that and you think, well, I'm being persecuted for being a Christian. No, you were just stupid. You didn't know when to stop. You didn't know how to be sensitive to people around you because a witness is going to leave a good witness. Now, certainly the gospel will offend. But if it offends, then, to back off, to not pass on. But you pray for that individual that they might come to that place where maybe they will be postured enough to hear. Maybe some things in their lives will cause them to really think things through. People do go through various stages. When you're a teenager and you hit that first crisis, you're very open to the Lord. Most people come to the Lord in that stage that do come to the Lord. Then if you get through that and you haven't yielded your life to the Lord, you get married and you start having children. And you start thinking, how am I going to raise my children? That's another crisis point where you really begin thinking about the Lord. So there are times when people are more open. Sometimes in a crisis situation of health, they look up to the Lord. We as Christians need to be sensitive to people, not push, not cajole people into hearing the gospel. We need to know when to speak and when not to speak. Fourthly, he says, and this is a repeat in verse 10, do not remove the ancient landmark nor enter the fields of the fatherless, Remember where they had the set patterns of where people's property lines were? Here's someone taking advantage of a widow or an orphan who doesn't really know his rights and responsibilities, and he's being ripped off. The Lord cautions that. He says, and again, this is a temptation to take advantage of people that are weaker than us. The Lord warns you that he's out for them. Their Redeemer is mighty, and he'll plead their cause against you. Redeemer is capitalized here as if to represent God. God certainly is the carer of the poor. He does care. He watches out for the widow and the orphan. This could also mean that even though this fatherless and this person of poor stature doesn't have the wherewithal to protect their property, they might have a near kinsman who would be their kinsman redeemer and able to buy that property back or to deal with that situation. And they might lose everything in court. I think the issue is this, that we might get away with taking advantage of someone in the meantime, but it's going to come back and get us one day. The Lord watches out for the weak. May not happen overnight, but he will take care of it. Notice the fifth exhortation here. Apply your heart to instruction and your ears to words of knowledge. We need to resist the temptation of wasting time, but apply our heart to that which is valuable, to hear the words of knowledge. This is frequently repeated, and it's needed because our flesh tends to continually resist against learning about the Lord. Verse 13 gives parents instruction. Do not withhold correction from a child. For if you beat him with a rod, he will not die. You shall beat him with a rod and deliver his soul from hell. Now, I know your attention is drawn immediately to that word beat, and it conjures up images in your mind of abuse. Understand that what is expressed here is not abuse in any way, shape, or form. In fact, what would be abuse is to withhold correction from a child, to withhold from them the needed correction, because the Bible understands, as it already expressed, foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, and the rod of correction will drive it from him. Here he tells you about this rod. If you have any questions about what a rod is, I know some tried to spiritualize a rod, expressing it didn't really mean a physical stick or anything of that nature. Well, here he's trying to explain, yes, it does. It's much better to correct your child with an implement that they can associate with discipline than your hand, which some people lose control and they start smacking their kids with their hands. And let me tell you something, that's abuse, that's wrong, that's inappropriate. Because then the child is going to associate your hand with that. The Lord, it counsels us to use an implement. Now, how should we administer this? Here's, to me, in the flesh, it's repulsive to me to administer pain. Just like it is probably repulsive to you. God has created us that way, and our flesh cries out against that. But we cannot be deceived in thinking that we can correct a child without it. Now, we might have effectively been able to use that rod when our children were young. You know, for example, a two-year-old is not going to listen to reason of why he can't run into the street. Little Johnny, please don't run into the street. You might get hit by a truck and we'd be very sad, boo-hoo. Well, that little child is not going to understand that. You know, they might just, the only thing they can understand, it might be that rod that's applied to that very soft portion of their backside that God has specifically created for such, use, I believe. I hear the one lady who was asked, she was honored for her three sons that had all accomplished great things in life, and was asked, what's your secret in raising these kids? And she said, a pat on the back, given often enough and low enough, produces great results. It's true. We need to understand this. Now, again, this might go against your feelings and how you think, oh, I just can't bring myself to think that that is a proper thing. I think that the Bible's wrong in this. Well, if you think that, I can tell you, you're listening to your heart and your heart is wrong. It's not correct in this. Now, some parents indulge their flesh in the wrong way. They overdo this. And I've seen examples of this that just break my heart, with parents not administering wisely and lovingly and privately type of discipline. I think it's important to do it wisely, lovingly, and privately in our culture. Some parents consistently threaten the rod and don't use it. That's equally unwise to frighten or scare or control a child that way, because you're teaching your children to lie. You know, you're not going to follow through with your word, and that's going to do more damage in the future for them. Children need to know not to take lightly authority. You would do them great service if you do not withhold correction from them when it is needed, but to be wise in the administration of it. Verse 15 brings us to the seventh exhortation here. The sixth was don't resist or withhold children's discipline. The seventh here now encompasses the whole rest of the chapter here, and really it's five exhortations to young people. He says, "My son, if your heart is wise, my heart will rejoice. Indeed, I myself, yes, my inmost being will rejoice when your lips speak right things." Here's kind of a picture of someone being, you know, the father, Solomon here, said, "I will be so happy if you are instructed in these things, if your heart is wise." I'll tell you, as a parent, there is no greater joy than to see your children walk in the truth of the Lord. There's something just so special about that I pray that happens with your children. And you know what? It can happen when you're faithful in those areas of raising them in the ways of the Lord. But now he gives instruction to his children. And of course, this does apply to all of us as children of the Lord. Verse 17 tells us, do not let your heart envy sinners. Be zealous for the fear of the Lord all the day, for surely there is a hereafter, and your hope will be not cut off. First exhortation to young people is don't envy sinners, but stay in the fear of the Lord. Now, we are envious oftentimes when we see the pleasure of sin. We see how Satan paints it in such a good light. Sin is such an attraction to our flesh. That's nature. I think if Satan were to come and be incarnate and take a job in this world, his job of choice would probably be that of marketing. Now, I'm not saying that if you're in marketing, you're doing Satan's work, okay? Don't take that wrong. I'm just saying that that particular occupation is a position of great influence over many people. You have the ability to stir up desires or create needs within people, and you can persuade them. And this is what Satan does. He paints sin in such a beautiful picture. He's working hand in hand sometimes with Madison Avenue, let me tell you. He can make it look so good, but it's not good in the end. I mean, the media portrays alcohol as such a cool thing, and they never show the consequences of it, very rarely. Or sexual promiscuity. I mean, it's like everybody's hopping in the sag with everybody in the movies and in shows, and it's all a part of life, but do they ever show venereal disease and the sexually transmitted diseases and the broken hearts and all the stuff that's accompanied with it? No, he just wants you to see the good side of sin. And so we're told not to envy sinners. To envy the sinner is like envying that beautiful bull, Chuck Smith said, that just won the blue ribbon at the county fair. Tomorrow it will be slaughtered. And that's what we do when we envy sinners. We envy just a portion of that, a little segment of what looks good. We don't see the end result. Like a lamb led to the slaughter. But by faith, we see the truth. Moses did not count it a bad thing to avoid the passing pleasures of sin in the Egyptian court, to take up the sufferings of Christ in the wilderness. Ask him now, was it worth it? You bet. We need to see the end result, and that's why he says, surely there is a hereafter, and your hope will not be cut off when you put the fear of the Lord first. You know, what is it going to be in the end? The hope of the ungodly, the Bible says, will perish. Imagine all your expectations, all your dreams, all your hopes and ambitions cut off suddenly, as opposed to one whose ambitions and dreams and hopes and desires are fully realized beyond his wildest imaginations. This is how different it is. So don't envy sinners. Don't fall into that trap. And the second thing he says here in verse 19 is avoid indulgent people. He says, do not mix with winebibbers or gluttonous eaters of meat. For the drunkard and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe a man with rags. I believe it's very important when you consider this. Verse 19 leads us into this section. He says, "Hear, my son, be wise and guide your heart in the way." I hear a lot of times people say, "I'm just following my heart in this." That sounds so good, doesn't it? Oh, it just sounds so noble, and it just feels so right when someone says it. I'm just going to follow my heart. Now, many times they mean that is to say, I'm not going to react. I'm going to follow my heart. I'm going to settle down. But understand this. It's a tragic shame because we don't know where our hearts will lead us. People oftentimes think, well, I just feel this is right. My heart tells me this. But in reality, you should be guiding your heart. You should be guiding your heart. You should not be following your heart. You should be leading your heart, telling yourself the right path, instructing your heart with truth. And then you will know what the right path is to do. And of course, in guiding your heart, you will not listen to the natural desires and urges of indulgent people, winebibbers and gluttonous eaters of meat. Excesses of wine, excesses of food is what he's referring to here. Look what happened to Lot when he saw the well-watered plains of Sodom and Gomorrah and he indulged. He ended up losing it all. Watch and pray that you not enter into temptation. A young, beautiful Christian girl in high demand in the world. You know, and it's amazing. She's impatiently waiting for Mr. Wright, and she sees little prospect among men in the church. And so she's tending to be around people that are searching after her. And, you know, I see this so often. Young, single, beautiful women, they're waiting on the Lord, and yet they get impatient. Because the thing they've got to learn is it takes time for Christ to be formed in men. They always ask the question, where are the godly men in church? Where are these guys that are following the Lord? And of course, the single men take issue with that. Wait a minute, I'm here. But they don't know. They haven't quite been developed yet. They've got to learn. They've got to grow. And I'll tell you, it takes time. It takes time. And you need to be patient with that. But you know, it's so fun just getting around with people that are just indulging themselves. But again, in the end, it's going to come to poverty. And it'll clothe you with rags. Listen to your father, he counsels, who begot you, and do not despise your mother when she's old. You know, the experience of those who are older in the Lord, very powerful. The experience of parents, very valuable. As a young Christian, I wanted to get around older Christians because I would learn so much just by watching their example. I would see their heart, and man, I'd be like, oh, okay, now I see how it's done. I see it in living flesh, how it should be followed. And what a difference that makes. Of course, their counsel is the third exhortation here, verse 23. He says, "Buy the truth and do not sell it. Also wisdom, instruction, and understanding." Now, how do you buy the truth? First of all, I want to mention, this is the verse that I wanted to put to memory. It's a verse that I put in the verse2remember.com. You can pick any of these verses to memorize. I will encourage you in that. I'm not going to put you on the spot, though, and try to pull you aside and ask you. I hope you have some friends in your life that do, though. That would be great. But here is a verse that sticks out strongly to me. Buy the truth. It's a strong statement. But how do we buy the truth? We purchase other things that we like or maybe that we need. How do we buy the truth? You know, in fact, we sacrifice to buy certain things. We save, we plan, we put away for the larger items in our lives. But understand that the money that you spend on those items represents a segment of your time. In order to buy a new car or clothes or vacations, it represents a certain amount of time that is traded in for wages. Here we're instructed to purchase the truth and not sell it. Well, you can't buy it like that with money, can you? So how do you purchase the truth? With your time that you're applying your heart to understanding. With the time that you spend in studying the Word of God, you are taking time that you could have went out and made money with, and you're investing it in truth. Now, how much time do you spend for the things that are temporary? How much do we spend for the things that are eternal? Where are you purchasing? It's fine to purchase items. If you've earned some money, it's fine. You're free to do that. But where are your priorities? Again, the whole idea of overworking to be rich, putting more into it than you need. Here, take some of that time. I lament men who overwork themselves to the sacrifice of their wives, the time they spend there with their children, and especially with the time that they could have used some of those talents and some of those abilities and some of those resources for the Lord, and lay up treasures in heaven where moth nor rust don't corrupt. They're not buying the truth. They're buying things that are temporary. And we only have so much time in our lives. I know in my own life there was a time I had many goals, many ambitions, many things I wanted to accomplish. I wanted to become an accomplished guitarist at one point. And when I first came out here, I picked up a guitar. I learned chords because I had no worship leader when we started the church. I was the worship leader. And, well, until you prayed me out, some of you, and I don't blame you at all. No time to practice. I wanted to become an accomplished pianist at one point, too. We, in fact, you know, when the kids were real young, we invested in a piano and we got it. And the hopes and desires that I can just see them growing up to play the piano like Mozart and, you know, myself learning how to do it. And, well, we still have it sitting in our living room and I can tweak out chopsticks, I think, and that's about it. There was a time I wanted to be a gymnast, you know, and I wanted a broad knowledge of the sciences, and I wanted to pursue my wrestling and grappling hobby until a level of entering competitions regularly. I wanted to get my single engine pilot's license as well. I played softball. I wanted to play basketball and develop into an A player racquetball player, and wanted to consistently golf with a handicap under 5. Yeah, right. I wanted to learn French, Spanish, and German. And at one point, I had tapes and lesson plans in all of those languages and started them, but never really got too far. In addition, I had a strong desire to become accomplished in biblical Hebrew and Greek, as well as modern Hebrew. I wanted to know the scriptures inside and out and memorize great portions of them and finish my education, get a doctorate in ministry and theology. Harsh reality of time passing so quickly, I realized I cannot be accomplished in all these things. I'm going to have to choose. You see, I had to sacrifice in one area or another to develop in other areas because there's only so much time. By buying one thing, I had to sell something else. It's the same thing. When you buy the truth, you understand there's a certain amount of selling off of other things. Other possibly okay pursuits, but not essential pursuits. You can stuff your life with all these things and become a jack of all trade, but it might rob you of doing the things that are important, to do one thing well. Paul the Apostle said, "This one thing I do, not a half a dozen things I dabble in." And I think that's important. Now, once I settled in my heart, I was determined to buy truth and never sell it. Now, it's fine for me from time to time to enjoy these areas that I was once driven to do. I've learned to be content in the level of proficiency. You'll never hear of me golfing in the 70s, I can tell you that. I will probably always have a little bit of a high handicap. I enjoy it, but it's just a pastime rather than something that I'm driven to. One thing is needful for me, and that's what I want to excel in. Paul's conclusion, he says, "I count all things but loss, but for the excellency of the knowledge of God, by the truth. And do not sell it. The father of the righteous will rejoice greatly. He who begets a wise child will delight in him. Let your father and your mother be glad, and let her who bore you rejoice." The best gift you can give to your parents is to walk wisely. Now, verse 26 says, "My son, give me your heart, and let my your eyes observe my ways." And now he gives the fourth exhortation to avoid immorality. He says, "For a harlot is a deep pit, and a seductress is a narrow well." A deep pit is one that when you fall in it, you can't get out. A narrow well is when you go down to get the water, you can't get back up. You're stuck. This is what happens with immorality. Oh, it looks delicious, tantalizing, appealing. And this is what happens when people follow their heart. You know, that woman at the office who's listening to the flirtations of those men around her that only want her body, want her attention, telling her things that are just so perfect. "Oh, I like you for your personality. You just got such a great personality." And you hear all those things, and eventually it leads into your heart going after that relationship. See, where you put your treasure, your heart will follow. And yet, a harlot is a deep pit. A seductress is a narrow well. This can go both ways for men and women. but it's going to affect you. Here it says she lies in wait as for a victim and increases the unfaithful among men. Now, he's writing to his son, so obviously he's talking about women. But it can go both ways. How many people have increased? And you know, it's funny, we laud unfaithfulness in this culture. We have movies titled Unfaithful. We have car advertisements that tantalize us with saying the stability of a marriage, but the excitement of an affair. That's on a car commercial. It's like the mentality of doing this is exciting and fun and can give some flair. I know that there are even counselors that have suggested people to have an affair to bring some spice into your marriage. You know, I don't think you can get any more stupid counsel than that. But it's out there. Just because they have the degrees after their name doesn't mean they're wise. There's some really good counselors out there. I'm not denigrating them all, believe me. But there's some real losers out there too. You have to measure everything yourself with what the Bible says. What a sad end. Victim, stuck in the pit. But not only, and by the way, in the areas of pornography, I think men and women both have to be very cautious with this. Your heart can be so caught up. But the lie of the lusts of the flesh is that there is the diminish in demand thing. The more you see it, the more you need more of it. And then you need worse stuff until it's degrading stuff that you're looking at. And then that doesn't satisfy. And eventually you need to act out some things. This is where people get started in so many horrible practices by tantalizing themselves. You're only going to get stuck in that pit. And I'll tell you, as a man, you need to have some men. I don't think you need to stand up in front of everybody and confess I'm struggling with this, but you do need to have some people in your life, men and women, to confess your sin to and to have prayer for to overcome those things. Then the final exhortation, verse 29, the danger of alcohol. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaints? Who has wounds without a cause? Or without cause. Who has redness of eyes? Now these are describing the short-term consequences of indulging in alcohol to a degree that you're out of control. Notice, those who linger long at wine. Those who go in search of mixed wine. Do not look at the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. Boy, doesn't that sound like a commercial? You know, I mean, they paint that picture really well. It tantalizes. It holds in the cup such promise of feeling good. And someone is going to be tempted by this picture. But notice what you've got to consider. In the end, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Ask Noah what happened to him as he planted a vineyard, drank of the wine, got drunk, and became uncovered in his tent. And his three sons saw him, and it created a whole havoc within his family. Lot, who got drunk, and his daughters slept with him because they were afraid they weren't going to get husbands after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And two people groups came out of that, those unions. One daughter gave birth to the Moabites, the other to the Ammonites, and they became perennial enemies to the people of Israel. So many people have been susceptible to attack, to weaknesses, to making decisions that were wrong. Notice he says, your eyes will see strange things and your heart will utter perverse things. Now, it's not the best translation here. Strange things is not in the neuter for things. It's more in the personal. You'll see a stranger. The implication is you're going to wake up in bed with somebody you don't even know. Wonder how you got there. You're going to be in vulnerable positions. He says, you'll be like one who lies at the top of a mast saying, they have struck me, but I was not hurt. They have beaten me, but I did not feel it. Pain is important to feel so that you are protected from what's destroying you. Alcohol removes that from you. I've seen so many people get addicted to alcohol, and it really, it hinders their growth. It's a form of tranquilizer, and tranquilizers prevent you from learning. You can hear, and then moments after, you don't really understand the lesson. I saw a scientist actually perform an experiment on a rabbit where he had the rabbit in his hand, And he took one rabbit and he was petting it, got to go to sleep, and then he dropped it and it woke up all of a sudden. And no matter what he could do, he couldn't get that rabbit to relax in his hands anymore. The rabbit had learned, can't trust this person. Then he took another rabbit and he got it to go to sleep after he gave it a tranquilizer. And then he dropped it, and the rabbit woke up, and then took the rabbit back in his hands, petted it, got it to go to sleep again, dropped it, it woke up, and repeated the process over and over and over again, and the rabbit never learned of what it should know. It couldn't receive how to translate that into practical application. This is what happens when you're under the influence of drugs and alcohol. You can't really learn. You can sit in church, you can hear this, you can go, oh, it's so good, I love that message, and go out and totally forget how it applies to your life. It's a dangerous place. You don't understand what's happening. And I lament at how many people struggle with this. And sadly, it starts when you're young. I have some statistics here from the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. And it's quite startling. Children under the age of 21 drink 25% of the alcohol consumed in this nation. More than 5 million high school students admit to binge drinking at least once a month. That is getting drunk and at least once a month. The age at which children begin drinking is dropping. It's now down to eighth grade. Regularly in eighth grade, people are drinking. Almost 30% of eighth graders are regularly drinking. The gender gap has not decreased. There's no difference between men and women now. And according to this statistic, alcohol is the number one substance abuse that's implicated in date rape, sexual harassment, racial disturbances, dropouts, overdose from deaths from alcohol poisoning, and suicides. So you're sitting down on the top of a mast. You don't feel it. You don't understand what's going on. Teenagers who drink are 7 times likelier to engage in sex and twice as likely to have sex with 4 or more partners, increasing risk to sexual diseases. High schoolers who drink are 5 times likelier to drop out of school. 80% of high school students have tried alcohol, while 70% have smoked cigarettes. And listen to this. Drinking, beer and alcohol are implicated in the 3 top causes of teen deaths: accidents, homicide, and suicide. All goes back to alcohol. The financial costs are astronomical. Those who continue, listen to this. Among high school seniors who ever tried alcohol, even once, 91% are still drinking by the 12th grade. So they try it once, they're going to continue, 90% of them. 83%, more than 2 million teens are still getting drunk in the 12th grade of those who try it first. Teen drinking is the number one source of adult alcoholism, and it's epidemic. It's 12 times likelier to use illegal drugs than those who don't drink. Pervasive influence in the media has just glamorized this, but this is what we're facing. All for this feeling for the temporary moment, what it's leading to. You know, I think of people have been affected by this. Now, all these aspects of exercising self-control, the future outcome is bleak if you just go after the momentary feeling, if you follow your heart rather than instruct your heart and guide your heart. There's a better way. Instead of indulging yourself, the Lord tells you that you will find your life by being self-controlled, in obedience, in action of love toward others. What a difference it is. No greater joy will you have than when you practice the love that the Lord has. It's the best deterrent for lust and vices in this world when you're actively involved in instructing yourself and putting to practice those things you learned. You want true happiness. It's not found by giving in to your desires. It's found by controlling your desires. That's the secret. And that's what I hope we will get from this chapter.